Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. On World Refugee Day, we'll begin with the report just out from the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees, Global Trends, Forced Displacement in 2017, and speak with Chris Boyan, the spokesperson for the UNHCR. After so much media attention focused on the plight of refugee children separated from their parents by the Trump administration, today President Trump reversed his cruel policy of ripping crying children from their mother's arms at the southern border. But across the world, the refugee problem is worse than it has ever been since World War II. So we will look at the wider global landscape in which 68.5 million people were displaced as of the end of 2017, with 44,500 people forcibly displaced every day. With one out of every 110 people in the world displaced, 20% are Palestinians, and the remaining two-thirds come from Syria, Afghanistan, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Somalia. And while nativist sentiments against refugees have been stirred up and exploited by President Trump and his advisers, anti-refugee and anti-immigrant policies with overtly racist overtones are on the rise, not just in the US, but across Europe too. Then we will speak with Barbara Crosset, the UN correspondent for The Nation and the senior consulting editor and writer for Pass Blue, which provides independent coverage of the UN, where she has an article, As Expected, the US Quits the UN Human Rights Council. She joins us to discuss how much the Trump administration's close ties to Israel influenced the decision, given the ridiculous number of times the UN criticizes Israel, and the expectation that in abdicating America's traditional role as the main champion of human rights, the vacuum on the council will be filled by China and Russia and others who will reshape human rights according to their definitions. Then finally, with the leading champion of Trump's zero-tolerance policy on immigration, Jeff Sessions, using the Bible to justify a state policy of child abuse, we'll speak with the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, the co-chair with the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. She joins us to discuss her article with the Reverend William Barber at The Guardian, Jeff Sessions Got the Bible Wrong, We Care for Strangers, Not Rob Their Rights, and how the real message throughout the Bible is reflected in Isaiah 10. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed. And joining us now is Chris Boyan, who's a former journalist, spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, who have just released a new report, Global Trends, Forced Displacement in 2017, coinciding with World Refugee Day today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Boyan.
Thank you, Ian.
And, of course, much of the attention on the news today is on President Trump in an unusual reversal. He's caved into enormous political pressure and signed an executive order to stop breaking up families and ripping kids from their parents at the southern border, although it's subject to legal challenges and it's not quite clear what the details are. Nevertheless, your report, the UNHCR's report, puts this in a broader context, does it not? What we're seeing on our southern border, which is horrifying the majority of Americans and led to the kind of pressure that forced President Trump to do an unusual reversal and back down. Right across the world, this is happening, is it not? In many cases, worse situations. People are drowning in the Mediterranean.
Yes, it is a global phenomenon we're seeing here. We have just yesterday issued our annual Global Trends report that documents the fact that around the world now there are over 68 million people who have been forcibly displaced by war, conflict, persecution in their countries. So yes, we are seeing a phenomenon occurring around the world that is really unprecedented in scale, and certainly since World War II, when displacement was extremely high, and which is really the origins of the founding of our organization and of the UN system in general. So it is a global phenomenon that we're witnessing here, and it is a tragedy that I think all of the organizations that address refugee situations and the governments that are most directly affected by this phenomenon are working very, very hard to address.
And when you say 68.5 million people have been displaced, that's in this one year, right, 2017?
No, that is it. That is the global total as of the end of 2017 of forcibly displaced people around the world.
Starting when?
Well, the times when this started, they vary. There are people that are still in refugee situations. For example, the average time for being a refugee now is around 17 to 20 years. And there are many people still living in large and very long-term refugee camp-like situations and camp situations in Africa. The vast majority of the world's refugees today, however, do not live in camps. It's important to understand that. Most of them are in urban environments. And the time they spend in being refugees varies, and the ways that governments determine when that time begins and above all when that time ends vary widely. So this is an aggregate figure that takes into account all of the different ways of that governments measure the duration of being a refugee and to provide this global total.
Well, what's particularly staggering, though, is that an estimated 44,500 people are forcibly displaced every day. So that's on top of the alarming total of displaced people at 68.5 million. That's the daily total. So it's continuing to rise, right?
It is continuing to rise. The number you just mentioned breaks down to a figure of one person being uprooted from his or her home every 2 seconds. So displacement is occurring now, and forced displacement is taking place around the world on a scale and at a rate that really hasn't been seen before. And our organization is working hard in concert and close support of governments around the world to propose new ideas and to propose new plans for addressing the challenge that the human race is facing today. We have all realized that business as usual is simply no longer an option. The numbers are such, and the scale and the types of conflicts that are driving forced displacement around the world are changing rapidly, and it is a situation that we believe is faced by all people, that no one country can manage or address alone, and that really does require concerted international action and cooperation among the governments of the world to address in a way that is effective, efficient, safe, and humane. We believe that the situation is manageable, but it does require focus, leadership, and collective action.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris Boyen, who's a former journalist and spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, who have just released a new report, Global Trends, Forced Displacement in 2017, coinciding with World Refugee Day today. So what's happening at our southern border, of course, is people are coming up from Central America with their children and trying to become or asking for a political asylum because they feel the countries they come from, Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, basically taken over by narcos and drug gangs, many of which actually originated here in Los Angeles, MS-13, for example, which President Trump talks about a lot. But the U.S. is challenging, or the Trump administration is challenging, the idea of political asylum. And is that happening across the world, that people coming to these countries, to European countries, for example, crossing the Mediterranean, are they economic migrants, or are they asking for political asylum? How do you break those figures down?
Ian, you raise a very good question, and a very important point needs to be made here. You're right. There are numbers of people on the move around the world that are higher than anything we have seen before. That's true. You will often see the word migrants and migration being used to describe all of the people on the move around the world. That is an umbrella term. That's a general term. But the UN Refugee Agency, it's important that people understand that our organization specifically focuses on a very distinct and vulnerable subset of the overall migrant movements in the world. I am talking about refugees per se, forcibly displaced people. And this is a distinction that we feel is very important to make, because nobody chooses to become a refugee. And it really does hinge on this question of choice. The refugees are forced to flee their homes, and by the way, a far larger number of what we call internally displaced persons. These are people who are forced to flee their homes, but who remain inside of their own country. And the numbers of internally displaced persons, or IDPs, is approximately double the number of refugees in the world. So this gives you a sense of the numbers of people that are moving and being uprooted from their homes and where they are going. But it's very important to make that distinction, because it is a matter of choice. And anybody, any human being that makes the decision, for example, to put their children into an unseaworthy boat and sail across the Mediterranean in the hope that whatever they might find on the other side will be better than the situation they're facing now, that is making that kind of decision, putting their own lives and the lives of their children at stake, for a very uncertain future, but to escape extremely horrific present, is making a very desperate decision here. And so it's important to understand that nobody chooses that willfully. It is really not a matter of choice. These are people that are fleeing their homes in order to remain alive and to escape war and conflict and persecution. And so of all the numbers of people on the move in the world today, the numbers of refugees per se are much, much smaller. And as I said earlier, this is a situation, and these are numbers that can be managed, but it does require focus. It requires a disciplined focus on facts and an action that is predicated by the core principles that human beings hold to be dear, and notions about how we would like the world to look today and tomorrow and down the road. And then that action needs to be applied by everybody equally. This is no one country's issue or a problem to shoulder alone. It really is everybody's responsibility. And to pretend that it isn't is derelict and is not going to be a solution in the long term. But we advocate solutions, and we know that the solutions are available, and we support governments around the world and civil society, NGOs, academics, philanthropists, the private sector, anybody who is interested in actually finding the solutions that are within reach to these issues, we encourage and support as best we can.
But, for example, the Palestinians have been refugees now for decades, right, since 1948. And that's, I think, the biggest part of the numbers that we're talking about here. And then you've got about two-thirds of refugees coming from just five countries: Syria, Afghanistan, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Somalia. There was an odd statement by President Trump today when he was talking about trying to secure the border, and he made the charge that people are coming in on our southern border from the Middle East, pretending to bringing in children, presumably from Central America. I have not heard of that. Have you heard of anything along those lines?
You know, as I mentioned before, nobody chooses to become a refugee, and there are people on the move all around the world, and in greater numbers today than we've ever seen before. The movements are quite mixed. We're seeing between people that are moving by choice, people that are being forced to flee, people that are falling into the hands of smugglers and trafficking networks. We're seeing all kinds of new ways that people are moving around the world, and it's a challenge for the governments of the world to get a handle on the numbers and the routes and the origins. It's a very complex picture that is emerging, that has emerged in recent years around the world, and so it would be very, very difficult to make any immediate conclusions about exact routes and about where people are coming from. You can look in all around the world. You can see areas where there are people on the move in that region who don't originate from that region, but who have found themselves there by virtue of either choosing to move in a certain direction or by virtue of having to pay smugglers or traffickers to get from A to B, to get somewhere. And so if you really drill down and look closely at the details of movements of people around the world, you will see some astonishing movements of people everywhere. And that's why we say, and we are advising governments around the world, that it is extremely important to make sure that governments have in place the capacity of human resources, but also the training, the reception facilities, precisely so that every single story can be heard and determinations can be made about who is and is not a refugee and who does and who does not need international protection. Because it doesn't apply to every human being, but it does apply to some, and it's imperative to identify those individuals among the larger group of people on the move, to identify those women and children and men whose lives are at risk in their home countries and who are genuinely fleeing to remain among the living. And that requires human capacity, that requires legal training, that requires an infrastructure in place that is able to identify those people and make sure that they receive the solutions that they're entitled to. And by the same token, to identify others who are not necessarily in need of international protection, who are not refugees, and find other solutions and essentially have them returned home safely and in dignity, but returned home. It's a different matter.
Well, Chris Boyena, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, Abby, speak with Chris Boyena, who's a former journalist and spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, who have just released a new report, Global Trends, Forced Displacement in 2017, which coincides with World Refugee Day today. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the U.S. has quit the UN Human Rights Council, leaving China and Russia to reshape human rights according to their definitions.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world below. There is no sickness, no toil nor danger in that bright land to which I go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Barbara Crosset, the senior consulting editor and writer for Past Blue, which provides independent coverage of the UN. She's also a United Nations correspondent for The Nation, and previously she was the UN bureau chief for the New York Times, and before that, its chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia. And her latest article at PastBlue.com is, as expected, the U.S. quits the UN Human Rights Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crosset.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, thank you, Barbara. And this is another act of unilateralism in a long line of actions where Donald Trump has pulled the U.S. out of collective global institutions, starting with the Paris Climate Accords, with the TPP, and a whole series of others. So do you see this in that context? Is this another example of unilateralism, xenophobia, isolationism?
Well, actually, if you take each one of those, and there are many more, as you know, areas in which the U.S. has withdrawn, experts in every one of those fields have spoken against these, what are seen as impetuous decisions. And the government has been criticized for really not doing its homework. And the president himself faced problems with his own cabinet members on some of these decisions. So it's an attempt, really, to do two things: to turn back the entire list of accomplishments of the previous administration of Barack Obama, and secondly, to really, I think, in a way, isolate the United States from having to participate in these international endeavors, and this, in a way, keeps the American people from knowing very much about some of the importance of some of these organizations and agreements. So it's a pattern now. I think everyone agrees, and as I say, experts in every one of these fields, from nuclear to environment to trade and so on, will come forward and say, "Wait a minute, this hasn't been discussed. It hasn't been talked over with Congress. These things are coming out of the White House. Bingo!" And that's what worries a lot of people, that there is no strategy.
Well, he also pulled out of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, and out of a UN-led global compact to manage the movement of migrants across the world. And on June the 19th, the UNHCR released its annual global immigration study called Global Trends, Forced Displacement in 2017, that finds that 68.5 million people were displaced at the end of 2017. And, of course, we're conscious of migrant movements, particularly on the southern border, with the recent zero-tolerance policy, which has led to so much outrage as children are separated from their parents. Everything that he does, though, Trump, helps China and Russia. Getting out of TPP was the greatest gift to China. Now China and Russia, aren't they going to move to redefine what human rights mean according to their standards, as opposed to the traditional understanding which the West, and particularly the United States, has championed?
Well, yes, this is a major concern, and I think the larger of the two concerns is China. I was surprised when I was writing an earlier article for The Nation magazine, I think it was, that China has been very active in Africa, we know, economically, but in the case of South Africa, it has begun to kind of, if I can use the word, tutor the South Africans in their human rights policies. This is South Africa is a very important country, of course, and so this is a step that really, in a way, kind of cements the relationship. An ambassador from a major Asian country told me just a week or two ago that we should be paying attention to the slow infiltration of so much of the UN. I don't want to make this sound like a witch hunt, but by the Chinese, by placing people in jobs, by working their way around all kinds of decisions. The most important one this year, and this is where we're watching Russia and China, is going to be important, is the selection of a new human rights commissioner. Now, with the U.S. out of the Human Rights Council, that doesn't mean they're not working behind the scenes to push somebody that they want, who they think will be more malleable, but the Chinese are still there and are influencing a lot of decisions. So, yes, Russia, China, and some of the G77 countries that really, really are, let's be honest, obstructionist often in the Human Rights Council, they get more space.
And again, I'm speaking with Barbara Crosset, the senior consulting editor and writer for Past Blue, which provides independent coverage of the UN. She's also a United Nations correspondent for The Nation, and previously she was the UN bureau chief for the New York Times, and before that, its chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia. And her latest article at PastBlue.com is, "As Expected, the U.S. Quits the UN Human Rights Council." And obviously, the U.S. is absolutely right in criticizing some of the people on that council who are human rights abusers, and many of them flagrantly so, and calling out hypocrisy. But isn't it better to be on the inside? I was going to quote LBJ. It's better to be inside the tent peeing out than outside the tent peeing in.
Right. Well, that's always been the feeling among people who have supported the Human Rights Council. In fact, I talked at some length with the last U.S. ambassador to the council, Keith Harper. Interestingly, he comes from the Cherokee Nation, and he was very important in the Human Rights Council in working on indigenous rights. A lot of things were accomplished during that period. So, you know, yes, there are many people there are many countries who are embarrassed or diplomatically kind of timid, which is what Haley is blaming them for, the ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley. She is disingenuous in Secretary of State Pompeo in saying that the U.S. has been working flat out for a year to try to reform the council. Well, first of all, in the U.N. system, you're not going to reform a major body in 1 year. But there has been an extraordinary effort by the Dutch and by a group of other countries that have worked through the year to try to come up with consensus that would keep the U.S. in while working with the countries that they think they can swing to vote for some forms of reform. And they produced, in January of this year, a very comprehensive report with specific proposals, and they got really no strong support from the United States at all. So a lot of the countries, such as South Africa and others, moved in and clobbered this reform effort. It's tragic because of the U.S. leaving, other people have said, it leaves the U.S. is still the big power. And the Human Rights Watch feels rightly, I think, that the U.S. has now stamped its policy on the only issue in the Human Rights Council, apart from the election of members, which takes a long period to get through the General Assembly, is the defense of one country, Israel. So it's become a singular issue with the U.S. In the Human Rights Council and elsewhere in the U.N. system. And this is not the work of a country that has to deal hugely in multilateral events and in multilateral policies.
Well, Nikki Haley and Pompeo, of course, pointed out the hypocrisy of the Human Rights Council and the issuing endless sanctions against Israel. You could make the case that they're obsessed with Israel in terms of wanting to criticize Israel, and this move was in many ways justified by that. But on the other hand, it's pretty clear that this new Trump government is more pro-Israel than any previous government, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and I think they're barely talking to the Palestinians. So is this, you know, essentially, whose agenda is working here? You're suggesting here that the U.S. is increasingly pro-Israel foreign policies pursued by Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and some of the president's most influential supporters, was capped in May by the choice of John Bolton as the president's national security advisor because he was put in there by Sheldon Adelson, the casino owner, who's a big supporter of Israel. So how do you balance that? On the one hand, the U.N. has been ridiculously critical of Israel, which undermines, you know, the need for real criticism, particularly the recent shootings of Palestinians in cold blood, just mowing people down. Thousands are wounded, an absolute outrage. But if you're doing it all the time, condemning them all the time, then when there's really something to condemn Israel for, then it carries no weight. Is that, at least that would seem to me, a real problem?
I think it gives some of the real enemies of Israel super satisfaction to see this happen. Now, this year, there were 5 resolutions, and, you know, it would be cynical to say so, but I will. They were silly in total, if you totaled them up. They were all not against Israel generally. They were against Israel's treatment of Palestinians. They were in the occupied territories, Golan and the West Bank and Gaza, the real occupied parts of the Palestinian state, the would-be Palestinian state. They were focused on that. One of the reform proposals of this Dutch-led group was to combine these. I mean, why do 5 resolutions just to get under the skin of the United States and others that are pretty much all the same, you know, with some differences? they recommended, the Reform Group recommended, that these be combined and that they also be combined with other special cases. So you would have one day of debate or 2 days, whatever they would have, and it would take not just Israel, it would be other countries that are special cases of interest or concern to the Council. This, I think, was pretty much squashed by several groups. And it came, and interesting you mentioned the movement of the capital of Israel to Jerusalem, supported by the U.S. This brought in a lot more Muslim and countries who were greatly outraged by this because it goes against all international agreements. So, there were ways suggested, but this is my own opinion. I think that at some point last year, the U.S. decided it was leaving the council. Haley started out her tenure by saying this council needs fixing, and she likes to fix things. And gradually she slid more and more into not wanting to fix, but wanting to go. And so by the end of 2017, it was pretty clear it was just a matter of time before the U.S. pulled out. But to hear it from other countries, they don't feel the U.S. put its weight behind reform, that wasn't a real thing. And these other countries are struggling to keep a reform movement going. And so without the U.S. standing up in the council and saying something on their behalf more often, the reform programs had to be put aside. The Dutch say they're still working on them, but they're going to do it now without the strength of the United States.
Well, but they have, in spite of having human rights abuses like Venezuela, China, Cuba, the Democratic Republic of Congo on the Human Rights Council, the UN Human Rights Council nevertheless have done investigations into Syria, North Korea, Myanmar, where there's ethnic cleansing going on, and South Sudan. The 2014 report on North Korea was a very important one, and of course President Trump is praising the murderous dictator of North Korea and ignoring that. But when
hypocrisy also.
Right.
What they were going after, the two of them speaking yesterday, apart from Haley calling the council a cesspool of political biases, non-diplomatic language by UN standards, but what can I say? That's what was happening.
Right, but when Nikki Haley and Pompeo criticized the Human Rights Council, and Haley cited Venezuela, China, Cuba, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, but she didn't mention Saudi Arabia. I mean, isn't there? That's obvious that they're buddy buddies. Trump did the sword dance. Apparently, Trump's main takeaway and what absolutely got him gushing over Saudi Arabia was all that gold on the walls. He couldn't believe it. So, isn't it?
Well, that's an interesting point because Saudi Arabia, Israel, and now the United States certainly. I mean, there's a lot of coalition forming or trying to form against Iran. I mean, this whole stuff was to get the U.S. lined up, the UAE is another one, lined up against Iran, and this was very much high in the Israeli strategy of preventing Iran from ever getting nuclear weapons. And in fact, wanting to abandon this agreement, which was negotiated for 5 years or something by all the permanent members of the Security Council and the EU. So there's something else going on in the Middle East, and Trump was feted by the Saudis, and obviously the Israelis have been working hard at the UN. They have excellent diplomatic presence in the United States. So they're important there, but as you were talking about Trump, sort of raining praise and really beyond the pale on Kim Jong Un, and meanwhile his Secretary of State is talking about hypocrisy in the Human Rights Council, and the whole world is watching children being locked up. There's something wrong here, and this, at fundamental level, is what is frightening to many Americans, that the U.S. is no longer, as a German said yesterday, a German minister, we're not in the same civilization with America.
So is that what you're hearing amongst, because Boris Johnson, the British Foreign Secretary, while critical of the UN Human Rights Council, Britain feels it's important to stay there, and he was critical of the US move to pull out. What are you hearing in general? Not from the human rights abusers and the ones that sanction Israel all the time, but from traditional allies and others. They must be feeling pretty bereft, are they not, that the major champion of human rights is now basically turning their back on the whole issue.
Yeah, and they also see it from all around the world for different reasons. They also see it as a common theme of the United States now. You can start way in the East. The Japanese, and to some degree some South Koreans, although not the president necessarily, Japanese are very worried that they're going to be sold out by the United States as Trump moves to do some kind of a deal with North Korea. Okay, that's there. In Europe, they're smarting from he loses no opportunity to attack NATO, to downgrade the European countries, who are going through a very difficult time because of the uncertainty of what's going to happen to the EU and the rise of populism. He's seen in many places as a person who is encouraging this kind of thing. In countries like Poland, he made a speech there that human rights groups talk about, that he's a destabilizing factor in their own politics, as well as in the international economic order. And his performance in Canada got huge attention in Europe, where he arrived late, he left early, he insulted everybody there. So he's a factor now of instability, which takes many forms and in many places. And this is carrying through, as I said, all the way around the globe.
Well, Barbara Grosset, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Barbara Grosset, the senior consulting editor and writer for Past Blue, which provides independent coverage of the UN. She's also a United Nations correspondent for The Nation, and previously she was the UN bureau chief for The New York Times, and before that, its chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia. And her latest article at PastBlue.com is, As Expected, the U.S. Quits the UN Human Rights Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the co-chair, with the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign.
Walk away now, and you're going to start a war. We expected something, something better than before. We expected something more. Walk away now.
Egypt means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is the Reverend Dr. Liz Theoharis, co-chair with the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, and the co-director of the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice. Having spent the last two decades organizing amongst the poor in the United States, she is the author of Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. And she has an article at The Guardian with Reverend William Barber, Jeff Sessions Got the Bible Wrong, We Care for Strangers, Not Rob Their Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Liz Theoharis.
Thank you so much, Ian. So good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And do we have a situation here in this country where the religious right has kind of usurped the Bible and sort of captured the patriotic high ground at the same time, and that what is needed is a revival of the religious left, which I take it you and Dr. William Barber represent?
Well, I think how Reverend Barbara and I talk about it is we don't like to call these so-called Christians the religious right because we think they're so wrong. And we don't identify ourselves as a religious left so much as following the moral center, the core of what our faith traditions teach us. I mean, when Jesus announces why he has come and what his role here on earth is to do, he preaches in Luke 4 that the Spirit of the Lord is upon him because he has been sent to bring good news. And that word, good news, in Greek is evangelios. It's the word for evangelical, right? So it's hard to understand how people can consider themselves evangelical in this country, consider themselves followers of Christ in this country, if they aren't lifting up the poor, welcoming the stranger and the immigrant, and making life better for everyone.
Well, that would be my question, because any kind of cursory reading of the Old Testament and the New Testament would indicate that, particularly in terms of the New Testament, that the prophet Jesus did not carry assault weapons, did not celebrate capital punishment, did not go on television and shake down poor people for money, and did not ask for $55 million from his followers to buy him the latest Gulfstream jet. It just seems to me that the problem we have here is somewhat similar to the problem we have with President Trump. He is at war with both the law and the truth. So you have the Bible, the truth, on your side because of what the Bible is about and what the prophet's about. Whereas, for example, at the risk of using the term the religious right, most of those television preachers, like the Reverend Hagee, as far as I can tell, there's only one book in the Bible that they preach about, and that's the book of Revelation.
Well, and even if we're going to talk about the book of Revelation, you have a story of oppressed people who are trying to organize against empire. But, you know, I am a Christian pastor. I'm a New Testament scholar. And who I follow, Jesus Christ, was a homeless person born in an occupied land who struggled his whole life to be able to make ends meet, who traveled around the countryside, setting up free healthcare clinics, feeding people, and preaching a gospel that a different reign was possible, a different society was possible, and it was all of our responsibility to do what God commands, which is to organize society around the needs of everyone. And so to me, if people consider themselves Christian, they call themselves Christian, and they're not making sure that they're uniting families, not separating them, if they're not making sure that their life and work is about feeding the hungry and housing the homeless and eliminating prisons, then I don't know what Bible you're reading. I mean, there are more than 2,000 passages in the Bible that talk about lifting up the poor, taking care of the vulnerable, and making sure that all thrive, not just barely survive. But somehow, for many years now, others have kind of hijacked the Bible and construed it in a way that damns people and that judges people and calls poor people sinners, when the real sin that God says is a sin in the Bible is poverty and oppression in the first place.
And again, I'm speaking with the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, who's a co-chair with Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, and the co-director of the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice. Having spent the past two decades organizing amongst the poor in the United States, she is the author of Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. And she has an article at The Guardian with the Reverend William Barber, Jeff Sessions Got the Bible Wrong. We care for strangers, not rob their rights. So let's just touch on Jeff Sessions' use of the Romans 13, citing the Apostle Paul, saying that commanding in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained them for the purpose of order, because that was also a section of the Bible that was used during Jim Crow to justify slavery. In your article, The Guardian, of course, you point out, just to buttress what you were just saying, Isaiah 10, woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed. And then from Jeremiah 22:3, this is what the Lord says, do what is just and right, rescue from the hand of the oppressor the one who has been robbed. Do no wrong or violence to the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood. So again, the truth is on the side of both the Bible and your interpretation of the Bible. And how are we going to win? How are we going to win when we're faced with a tyranny of the minority, with something like 30 to 40% being represented by this minority government that is changing the country so fast? And just from a journalist's point of view, it's absolutely exhausting trying to keep up with the mendacity and the daily manipulation that's going on as you watch your country really being eviscerated and its reputation and standing in the world being desecrated.
No, these are indeed dark and dangerous times. I mean, every week, every day, in fact, something that is about punishing poor people and dividing us and making life worse for the majority of people, you know, seems to be happening. That's why Reverend Barber and myself and thousands of leaders across this country are building the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. And we've been engaging for the past 6 weeks in nonviolent civil disobedience, direct action, organizing, education, building and seeding a moral movement in this country to make life better for everyone. And you know, from the perspective of poor people and moral leaders and clergy who are at the leadership, at the helm of this campaign, while things do seem very bleak, while it is true that 140 million people are poor and low income in this country, while it is true that 4 million people, when they turn on households, when they turn on their water taps today, they had leaded water coming out of them. While it is true that we have fewer voting rights today than we did 50 years ago, and that we're actually walking backward instead of forward, people are rising up and saying, you know, we can do better than this. We've been doing these weekly rallies and actions, and you know, a couple of weeks ago, standing in front of the U.S. Capitol, Nick Smith from the Fight for 15 said, you know, we have our backs against the wall. And what you can do in that moment is push. And people are pushing. You know, tens of thousands of people have been engaged in this Poor People's Campaign already. And folks are hearing that there are people who think that the real moral issues of our day are health care and living wages and voting rights and housing and education and equity in education and the things that, you know, make life good for everyone and the kinds of things that this society is able to provide. But do we have the will? And so, you know, I think what we do in the face of that is we organize, right? I mean, and I think that's what people, grassroots people, the kind of heroes and heroines of our country, you know, unsung saints that people don't hear about. I mean, living in homeless encampments in Aberdeen, Washington, or living with raw sewage in their yards in Lowndes County, Alabama, folks are coming forward saying, we're going to link up with our brothers and sisters in El Paso, Texas, at the border. We're going to link up with the moms that are losing their kids because they don't have water in Detroit, and we're going to build a powerful movement that's going to change the kind of direction that everything's going in. Because that is only what has changed things in the past. It's only when people come together across lines, across racial lines, across religious lines, across geographical lines, across issue lines, that then we can build a movement and we can actually change things for the better.
But in terms of what we can do in the practical sense of the political instruments at hand, because as I mentioned, we have a tyranny of the minority. You've got three branches of government controlled by the Republicans, largely through gerrymandering the House, and Donald Trump was only won by 77,000 votes, and the person who lost got between 3 and 4 million more votes than he did. So as far as I can tell, all that we can do to stem the tide of destruction and desecration going on both nationally and internationally at the hands of the Trump administration is to vote and to get every last person out to vote, even as they try to take away voting rights. It still comes down to people power. So how do you translate your work, Dr. Liz Theoharis, in terms of the Poor People's Campaign from getting poor people to vote? Because if the 140 million that you talked about voted, I think the country would change.
Well, so, I mean, that's what this campaign is about. This campaign is about shifting the national discourse, shifting the narrative, right? In the 2016 presidential election, there were 25 or 26 presidential debates, both in the primary and in the general election. And not one of those debates took up voting rights and the suppression of voting rights. Not one of them took up poverty or living wages or single-payer health care or any of the issues that would actually, you know, kind of relate and be really important to the majority of the people living in this country. And so this campaign is about shifting the discourse, shifting the narrative, and building the power of people. And that means voter registration. That means voter mobilization. That means organizing people in states across the country, going to places where nobody goes, and hearing people, lifting people up, putting together a set of issues and demands that would actually solve and get people involved in this democratic process. I mean, including the fact that we need and are demanding automatic registration at the age of 18. I mean, why is it that in this country you can be automatically registered for the draft, but you aren't automatically registered to vote? And in fact, even in the last couple of weeks, more voter suppression laws have been upheld in Wisconsin, in Ohio. You know, voter suppressors are being emboldened right now. And when you look at racist voter suppression, you see places that are engaging in that have the highest poverty, have the lowest wages, have the people with the least amount of health care. And so if we don't take a hold of voting rights, if we don't get people involved in voting and voter registration and voter mobilization, especially amongst the poor, and if we don't have candidates that actually are talking to the issues that impact people's lives, then things aren't going to get better. But that's why we are organizing, why we are registering people to vote, why we are getting people involved in a social movement that can have people's votes count and have people's issues heard and have solutions to those problems instead of what we're dealing with right now.
Well, for example, in Australia, where I was born, the law is that you have to vote. And if you don't vote, you get like a ticket, you know, like a parking ticket. And 90-something percent regularly vote. And even right-wing governments, as a result, have got to take care of the poor and the middle class, because that is a major voting constituent. And I think the problem we have, you just mentioned in the last election, there was scant reference by any of the candidates, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, of the issues that you're fighting for. So if you build that constituency, then they're going to have to address that constituency. What is your argument to the poor people in this country who can barely make it, who are distracted by financial problems, by lack of logistics, even getting to the polls? They don't make it easy to vote in this country. There's no two ways about it. How do you inspire people to recognize that these rights that they have that they're not using could turn into a very powerful weapon?
Well, first of all, I mean, so many people's voting rights are actually being suppressed. And so I think we have to start with actually advocating for voting rights. But we also have to, you know, engage with people, find out what people's issues are. In many cases, there's lots of reasons why people aren't voting. There aren't candidates that are talking to the issues that they're concerned about. So that's why you need a movement. That's why you don't need just a particular political party to try to register voters, but that's why you need, you know, people coming together saying things can be different and this is how they have been in history. And so, I mean, that's where this Poor People's Campaign really comes in. I mean, we're able to, you know, be out there in communities with regular folks just talking about the issues that affect us, and then showing in history and today how it does matter for people to vote, how it does matter for people to participate in our democracy, and how we can figure out how to house people and how to have living wages and how to have health care and how to have the things that people need, you know, to actually survive. I mean, you know, what Dr. King talked about in the last years of his life was the power of poor people. And he talked about the poor in this country live in a cruelly unjust society. If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life. And so much of what this campaign is about is helping poor people to take action together. And that is action to the ballot box. That is action just in the community around the issues that matter to people. And as people see that they can change the conditions they and their families and their communities are living in, and as then we're able to build a society that actually, you know, echoes and shows the values that people actually have, which are good education for everybody, which are that everyone should have a decent place to live, because that's what people believe. It's just how do you to make that a reality for folks.
And the people who are taking away our votes, and particularly the votes of poor people and minorities, they clearly know how valuable the vote is, right? That's why they're doing it.
Absolutely. And I think it's become very clear, you know, as we've traveled around the country building the Poor People's Campaign, and why we've started with this key issue of voter suppression, because nobody has been talking about it. I mean, the fact that we had a presidential election with the level of voter suppression that took place. I mean, I'm originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In the state of Wisconsin, there were 250,000 votes that were suppressed. Trump only, you know, supposedly won by 30,000 votes. And so to see that kind of power, that like the reason they're taking people's votes is because folks are going to try to vote folks in that have their interests in mind, it is a great example of the power of people, but only the power of people coming together and staying together and organizing together and not just turning out for an election, but staying organized and staying as a powerful force to say this is how things should be and they can be if we make them so.
Well, the Reverend Dr. Liz Thea Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with the Reverend Dr. Liz Thea Harris, who's the co-chair with the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, and the co-director of the Caris Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice. Having spent the last two decades organizing amongst the poor in the United States, she is the author of Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. And she has an article at The Guardian with the Reverend William Barber, Jeff Sessions Got the Bible Wrong. We care for strangers, not rob their rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.